This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. Plans for an expected Russian ceasefire collapsed Sunday, Ukrainian officials said, as they tried to persuade Russia to agree on terms for safely getting residents out of areas under fire near Ukraine's capital. The news dashed hopes of progress in easing the war, which is in its 11th day. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has renewed his call for the world to impose a no-fly zone. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
NATO has refused to impose a no-fly zone to date, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken tells NBC's Meet the Press President Biden has been clear U.S. forces will not engage in direct conflict.
American planes flying against Russian planes or our soldiers on the ground in Ukraine, because for everything we're doing for Ukraine, the president also has a responsibility to not get us into a direct conflict, a direct war with Russia, a nuclear power, and risk a war that expands.
If no fly zone, Zelensky appealed for planes. Blinken says the possibility of Poland doing that is being discussed.
If it chooses to send the MiGs and the Su planes that it has to Ukraine, how we can help by backfilling what they're giving.
Russia's defense ministry is warning Ukraine's neighbors against hosting Ukrainian warplanes, saying that could make them part of the conflict. I'm Ben Thomas.
The presidents of Turkey and France, as well as Pope Francis, appealed to Russian President Vladimir Putin to negotiate to end the conflict. A Russian defense ministry spokesperson said Sunday that some Ukrainian combat planes had redeployed to Romania and other Ukraine neighbors. He warned an attack from planes operating out of those nations could be deemed an engagement by them in the conflict. By remote, this is VOA News. People from African, Asian, and Latin American countries stuck in Ukraine and trying to get out say they're facing discrimination and are left to evacuate themselves. AP's Karen Chamas reports.
Many foreigners who succeed in getting out, like Nigerian student Alexander Somtor Ara, are now forming impromptu networks to help thousands of others hoping to flee. Ara is one of many who describes xenophobia and threats of violence as he approached the border with Poland shortly after Russia's invasion.
The police also stood in a shooting position just like the other one, and he wanted to shoot us.
After days in the freezing weather, the young foreigners protested and were eventually allowed to cross. Since reaching Warsaw, the capital of Poland, he has returned to the Ukrainian border to help other foreigners trying to leave. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, says all refugees should be treated equally.
There has been disturbing indications of discrimination against African and Asian nationals while fleeing, and the office will be watching this situation attentively.
I'm Karen Chamas.
And the timing of an American WNBA player arrested on a drug charge in Russia is being questioned as the U.S. government urges all U.S. citizens to leave immediately and issues a do not travel advisory. AP correspondent Julie Walker.
Brittany Griner was arrested in February at a Moscow airport with vape cartridges containing cannabis oil, according to Russia. In the offseason, she plays for a local team and was trying to leave because of war with Ukraine. The WNBA confirms all other players got out of the two countries. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. is ready to help.
Whenever an American is detained anywhere in the world, we, of course, stand ready to provide every possible assistance, and that includes in Russia.
Two other Americans, former Marines Paul Whelan and Trevor Reed, have been held by Russia for years. The U.S. saying the charges are fabricated in what's being called hostage diplomacy. I'm Julie Walker.
The official global death toll from COVID-19 is just shy of 6 million. The milestone is the latest reminder of the unrelenting nature of the pandemic. Even as people are shedding masks, travel is resuming, and businesses are reopening around the globe. South Africa in particular has been hit hard, counting over 3.5 million infections. The death toll compiled by Johns Hopkins University is at 5,998,819 as of this moment. It's expected to pass the 6 million mark at any moment now. For more on all of these stories, please visit us at voanews.com or download our mobile app. Via remote, Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Today is Monday, March 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russian President Vladimir Putin turns down calls to end the invasion of Ukraine as efforts to evacuate civilians from the city of Mariupol fails.
His remarks were made in a phone call with Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan, who appealed for a ceasefire in the conflict, as did French President Emmanuel Macron, who held a nearly two-hour phone call with Putin on Sunday.
The UN urges the Sri Lankan government to reform its judicial system and put an end to impunity.
The UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says she is pleased to see that Sri Lanka has taken certain steps to amend some provisions of the Prevention of Terrorism Act.
And a look at International Women's Day, which aims to focus global attention on gender equality, bias, stereotypes, and discrimination. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Sunday his campaign in Ukraine was going according to plan and would not end until Kyiv stopped fighting as efforts to evacuate the heavily bombarded city of Mariupol failed for a second day in a row. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
His remarks were made in a phone call with Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan, who appealed for a ceasefire in the conflict, as did French President Emmanuel Macron, who held a nearly two-hour phone call with Putin on Sunday. Nearly 1.5 million people have fled in what the UN calls the fastest-growing refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. Efforts to evacuate some of the 400,000 residents from the heavily bombarded city of Mariupol failed for a second day on Sunday. The Ukrainian coastal city has endured days of shelling, trapping people without heat, power, and water. Kyiv has renewed its appeal to the West to toughen sanctions, and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky asked again on Sunday for a no-fly zone to be introduced for all Russian rockets.
If you don't do it, if you do not provide us with at least planes so that we can defend ourselves, then there is only one conclusion to make. You also want us to be killed very slowly.
He added that Russia was preparing to bombard another southern city, Odessa. Washington and its NATO allies have resisted Ukraine's appeals for a no-fly zone for fear that it would escalate the conflict beyond Ukraine's borders. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Sunday said that the U.S. had seen very credible reports of deliberate attacks on civilians, and that Washington was documenting these reports to support potential war crimes investigations. Russia denies attacking civilian areas. The West has ratcheted up sanctions and scaled up efforts to rearm Ukraine, sending in items ranging from Stinger missiles to anti-tank weapons.
That's Lauren Anthony of Reuters. After Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine, sweeping sanctions by the U.S. and the European Union, coupled with a mass exodus of foreign companies, have left Russia more isolated. The value of the ruble has plummeted to a record low. What will make Putin to back down? Or is that even possible at this point? VOA's Carol Van Dam put that question to Stephen Pfeiffer, a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and fellow at Stanford's University's Center for International Security and Cooperation.
I think that's a big question. I mean, I'd say 10 or 15 years ago, Vladimir Putin was he would do fairly rational calculations of costs and benefits. What I worry about is that he seems recently to have become much more emotional and really angry about Ukraine. And I wonder if that clouds his judgment. But look at the cost. I mean, the economic sanctions that are being applied, the isolation. I mean, if you're a Russian now, you want to fly to the West, you can't. Europe, the United States, Canada have all closed their airspace to Russian aircraft. And other sanctions, I mean, Boeing and Airbus now have banned providing spare parts to Russia. So all of those Boeing and Airbuses, you know, at some point in a month or two, aren't going to be able to fly safely because they will not have been properly maintained.
So they're increasingly isolated in Russia.
They're increasingly isolated. And I think the big thing, I mean, and I was actually quite frankly surprised, but yesterday the Russian Ministry of Defense announced that 500 soldiers, Russian soldiers, have died in Ukraine. My guess is that number is quite a bit more, and my guess is most Russians expect it's quite a bit more. So those costs are beginning to pile up. And at some point, does the Kremlin conclude that the course that they've launched is not going to succeed, that the costs are just too much? And do they find some way maybe to declare victory and then leave? I don't know. I think the other factor here that we don't know is, in part because Mr. Putin has built this very security service controlled society in Russia, you know, protesting is dangerous in Russia. But one does wonder at some point when the Russians understand the economic impact. I mean, they watched the ruble fall by 30% on Monday morning, and that's going to have impact. I mean, inflation in Russia is going up.
Not only are the Russian people feeling the hit, but these people, this is not 1924. I mean, these people have access to the internet and television, and a lot of people may not just take Putin at his word that this is not an invasion, that this is just a special operation.
I think here is, in Russia right now, the Kremlin does control the main television media. And what the Russian people are being told that this is it's not an invasion. In fact, if you're a media outlet in Russia and you say invasion or war, you can be shut down. It's a special military operation. And they're being fed, I think, a whole range of lies that there are Nazis in Kyiv, that Ukraine is trying to get nuclear weapons, that Ukraine was committing genocide. The one change, though, from earlier, 100 years ago, is that you now have the internet and social media. And do you begin to see the public, even if it's not going in large numbers of streets, that the public sentiment really begins to turn against this? And it would not be just a result of the economic sanctions and the isolation from the West, but really because large numbers of Russian soldiers are dying in Ukraine.
That's Stephen Pfeiffer, a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and fellow at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam, from Stanford, California. Pakistani security officials say they have arrested a suspected mastermind and accomplices of a suicide bomber who killed dozens of worshippers during Friday prayers at a Shiite Muslim mosque in northwest Peshawar province. Security has been beefed up in minority places of worship after Islamic State said in a statement that a lone suicide bomber was from a neighboring Afghan affiliate known as IS in Khorasan province. The attacker shot two police guards guarding the mosque before entering inside and exploding his device, killing 63 people and injuring over 200. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gar.
It seems that there has been a significant breakthrough if you go by what the provincial police chief told reporters even today, and the provincial government, that they have arrested several people and they have been able to reach to the planner of this attack, but they were reluctant to share further details and promised to hold a press conference probably on Monday to present these suspected planners of the attack. So they appeared in this press conference quite confident that they were finally able to arrest some key people, and they have also been able to identify the suicide bomber, who they said was an Afghan refugee who has been living with his family in Pakistan among the Afghan refugee population for years, and that he had recently returned from Afghanistan, where, according to police, he received training for this attack over the last couple of years. And his parents have also been investigated, and they have told the authorities that their son had long been missing, and they suspected that he had joined the Islamic State. So that's where things stand as of this moment.
Has the authorities been able to identify motive for this attack?
We know that there's a history of Islamic State Khorasan conducting attacks against Shiite minority here in Pakistan and on the other side of the border in Afghanistan. And this attack was quite similar to previous attack that the Islamic State Khorasan has carried out. So obviously it's the same pattern that this terrorist group has been adopting, that targeting the minority Shiites or Shiite Muslims, who they say are basically hurting Islam, and so that's why they have to be eliminated according to the Islamic State assertion. So it's the same pattern, same style, the way they attack this crowded mosque in Peshawar on a Friday afternoon prayer, which is obviously mass prayer, and there were at least 400 people inside this prayer hall. We know that Islamic State has also formally claimed responsibility for this attack on its Mark News Agency international media outlet, according to this group. So there's no question, there's no doubt now that who was behind it, but that is Islamic State Khorasan, according to even U.S. officials and Pakistani officials, is becoming increasingly dangerous in this region. And they, according to police officials today at the press conference, that they are orchestrating these attacks in Pakistan from their sanctuaries on the Afghan side of the border.
Some Shiite groups are accusing the government of not providing enough security. How is the government responding and what are they doing about it?
Obviously, we have seen an increase in security of worship places of minorities, not only Shiite minority, but other religious minorities in Pakistan. But as far as the criticism about government not being able to properly protect these worship places, obviously, the government and the police chief of the province told reporters that the attacker was intercepted by two police guards who were sitting at the entrance gate. But obviously, he was well-trained, so he just shot and killed them before entering the mosque. And it is very difficult, obviously, according to the police officials, to guard each and every worship place. It's a country of obviously 220 million people, and there are so many minority worship places across the country. And, you know, interestingly, the Islamic State chose this time of the week to carry out this attack because there's a polio vaccination campaign going on. And police officials told reporters that several thousand policemen have been guarding these polio vaccination teams. And then there are other sensitive areas or worship places in the province where police have been deployed. So obviously they were complaining of a lack of number of police personnel to fully guard these places.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gao speaking with me from Islamabad. According to the Global Terrorism Index, sub-Saharan Africa accounted for nearly 50% of global terrorism deaths. The Sahel is home to the world's fastest growing and most deadly groups. The index highlights that terrorism remains a serious threat. Four of the 10 countries with the largest increases in deaths are in sub-Saharan Africa: Niger, Mali, the DRC, and Burkina Faso. Reporter Angie Omar discussed the issues with a resident scholar at the American Institute, Michael Rubin. He previously worked as an official at the Pentagon, where he dealt with issues relating to the Middle East, and as a political advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority.
President Paul Kagame of Rwanda, when he was looking at the prevalence of coups, had talked about governance and the fact that oftentimes coups happen when there isn't good governance. Well, that also applies to terrorism. What we see throughout the Sahel is a succession of weak governments, and those weak governments create an opportunity for terrorists to take root and to thrive. I visited Mali about 20 years ago, and at the time, Mali was among the most democratic countries in Africa until a coup overthrew the government, and we've had a succession of weak governments. So it's not a surprise as a follow-on that terrorism thrives. When we look at the growing prevalence of terrorism in the region, I think it's a direct result of weak government. Across the Sahel, governance is weak, democracy is in decline, and that gives an opportunity for terrorism to thrive.
Both Burkina Faso and Mali have seen a steady increase in terrorist violence attributed to Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin, an affiliate of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. With France pulling out its forces from Mali, who will fill the vacuum in combating terrorism in the Sahel?
Well, you know, the government in Mali is turning to Russia and the Wagner Group in order to fill the vacuum, but ultimately that's a band-aid on a sucking chest wound. That's not going to help. And in fact, when we look at situations like the Central African Republic, the Wagner Group, oftentimes with its human rights violations and with its theft of resources, actually makes the situation worse. And so kicking France out, I don't think is going to solve the terrorism problem. It's going to make things much worse. And so if the government in Mali, if the government in Burkina Faso is trying to find an alternative to France, honestly, I don't think it works. There's no cheap remedy here.
From March 2019 onwards, clashes between the Islamic Maghreb and the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara have been recorded along the Burkina Faso-Mali border as they compete for influence, recruits, and resources. What are the domestic factors that facilitate recruiting by the two terrorist groups?
Well, first of all, again, we come to weak governance and the impact that has as it trickles down on society. when you have weak government, when you have governments that exploit the resources but don't necessarily give opportunities to the people, then youth become desperate. And we certainly see this in areas initially in northern Mali, much more broadly now. We've also seen this traditionally in places like Bobo Dioulasso and Burkina Faso, much more broadly now. Osama bin Laden, the late leader of Al-Qaeda, said that when you see a strong horse and when you see a weak horse, people naturally gravitate to the strong horse. And so what you also have is a dynamic in which various terrorist groups are trying to depict themselves as strong vis-a-vis not only the national governments, but also terrorist rivals. And so we can expect an increase in violence until one of the terrorist groups achieves dominance over the other.
That's Michael Rubin, a resident scholar at the American Institute, who previously worked as an official at the Pentagon. He spoke with reporter Angie Omar. In other news, the world is on the verge of recording its 6 millionth official COVID-19 death, underscoring that the pandemic is far from over. It's another tragic reminder about the deadliness of the pandemic. Even as masks are dropped, travel is resuming and businesses are reopening around the globe. Remote Pacific islands are just now grappling with their first outbreaks. Hong Kong is battling its worst outbreak and clinging to mainland China's, quote, zero COVID strategy, unquote. Eastern Europeans battling a spike in deaths and are facing a surge of refugees from war-torn Ukraine. And the United States is nailing the mark of 1 million deaths on its own. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is urging the Sri Lankan government to reform its judicial system and put an end to impunity, which encourages human rights violations to proliferate throughout the country. A report is under examination at the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, says she is pleased to see that Sri Lanka has taken certain steps to amend some provisions of the Prevention of Terrorism Act. She says that has resulted in the release of some people who have been detained under the act, but says proposed reforms do not go far enough. She says much more is needed to reform the country's legal and security systems to put an end to impunity and prevent any recurrence of past violations. The High Commissioner is referring to the period after Sri Lanka's civil war ended in the 1980s. Some 60,000 to 100,000 people from all ethnic and religious communities disappeared. The fate of thousands of those who have gone missing remains unknown to this day. Regrettably, she says, few have been held accountable for the crimes. She says victims and their families continue to be denied truth and justice.
I remain concerned by the continued suffering and anguish of victims and families of the disappeared, who call for truth and justice and seek to commemorate their loved ones. I urge the government to acknowledge their rights, urgently determine the fate or whereabouts of victims, bring perpetrators to justice, and provide reparations.
Bachelet says she's deeply concerned by continued reports of surveillance, harassment, and intimidation of civil society organizations, human rights defenders, and journalists by police and intelligence services.
Repeated incidents of death in custody and in alleged armed encounters with police are alarming. We also continue to receive allegations of ill treatment and torture by police and military. This highlights the importance of fundamental security sector reform.
Bachelet warns Sri Lanka will not achieve genuine reconciliation and sustainable peace as long as impunity prevails. Sri Lanka's foreign minister, Lakshman Peris, says there are serious anomalies and weaknesses in the report presented to the Council by the High Commissioner.
The fundamental deficiency is its intolerably intrusive character, impinging as it does on core functions and responsibilities of organs of the Sri Lankan state, overwhelmingly mandated by the people of our country at three successive elections.
He says he deeply regrets the numerous unsubstantiated allegations that have found their way into the report. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
International Women's Day is celebrated on March 8th. aims to focus global attention on the state of women when it comes to gender equality, bias, stereotypes, and discrimination. Its goal is to make the world more diverse, equitable, and inclusive for them. VOA's Laurel Bowman has the story.
We've heard the famous quotes, "Behind every great woman is another great woman. Investing in a woman is investing in a community. When women move forward, the world moves with them." International Women's Day on March 8th invites the world to focus on where women are and where they need to go. In the United States, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation held a virtual two-day forum to highlight International Women's Day. Paloma Adams-Allen is with USAID.
Real progress has been made in recent decades, yet women and girls continue to shoulder a profoundly disproportionate burden of the impacts of today's global challenges.
There were shout-outs for women in Ukraine, whose country is under attack by Russia. Again, USAID's Paloma Adams-Allen.
As the conflict continues to unfold, we're seeing women play a crucial role in resisting Russia's campaign of violence, responding to the urgent needs of their communities, combating disinformation, taking up arms to fight, and engaging on the diplomatic front.
Experts also noted that women around the world have carried a good bulk of the burden in responding to the global COVID-19 pandemic, as both healthcare workers and caregivers, both in the home and in the workplace. Rachel Vogelstein is with the White House Gender Policy Council.
Child care, elder care, home care too often are inaccessible and unaffordable, while at the same time, care workers scramble to care for their own families, even as they take care of others.
Meantime, women were forced out of jobs during the COVID-19 pandemic. In the U.S., more than 3 million women exited the labor market over the past 2 years, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation, with women's participation in the workplace lower than it's been in over 30 years. And women and girls are more likely to be killed by natural disasters as the rate and severity of climate shocks increase globally, according to USAID. Advocates for women's rights would also like to see more women in top government and political roles. U.S. Congresswoman Jennifer Gonzalez represents Puerto Rico and is the co-chair of the Congressional Women's Caucus.
We need to have more girls and women participating in civics and politics. I think even when we are almost 49% of the population, we are not equally represented in the positions of power.
Experts laud the progress women have made so far, but want to see more when it comes to gender equity, diversity, and inclusiveness. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday at 2105 UTC, join me, Steve Miller, as I put the latest developments into a global context with interviews and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
The Basketball Africa League is back. Voice of America joins forces with Africa's premier men's basketball league to bring you the second season of the BAL. It is game on March 5th, 2022. 38 games, 12 teams leaving it all on the court in Senegal, Egypt, and Rwanda to determine the 2022 season champion. Tune in to VOA 24/7, FMs, and to our radio and TV affiliates for some action. Pre-game, play-by-play, post-game, daily highlights, delivered by our finest commentators. Basketball Africa League 2022 on Voice of America. May the best team win.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Adofo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
the voice of America. Washington, ba-ba-ba-zip.